George Harrison and Eric Clapton embarked on a singular personal and creative friendship that impacted rock's unfolding future in resounding and far-reaching ways. In All Things Must Pass, George Harrison, Eric Clapton, and other assorted love songs traces the emergence of their relationship from 1968 through to the early 70s. Womack and Krupa, that's Ken Womack and Jason Krupa, have written the book. Delighted to be joining me live on the line from the US. Both Ken Womack and Jason Krupa, author of All Things Must Pass Away, Harrison, Clapton, and other assorted love songs. Good afternoon, well, good afternoon from us. Good morning to you, gentlemen.
Good afternoon.
Good morning. Good afternoon.
Good morning. Right. So, first of all, can we just identify who is who? So, Jason, if you can say good morning to Spain.
Good morning to Spain.
And Ken, the same, please.
Oh, good morning to Spain.
Indeed. Jason, whereabouts in the States are you today, then, please?
I'm in New Orleans.
Oh, so to be in New Orleans on a Friday. And Ken, yourself?
I'm in Texas.
Well, but God's own country as well. So tell me a little bit about, I don't often get envious about people because obviously we're based on the Costa del Sol, which is a particularly nice part of the world to be, but hey, tell me a little bit about then the situation that existed, because obviously Beatlemania had come and swept all before it, but by the White Album, you could say that Harrison was, well, the whole Beatles were embarking on different paths. Meanwhile, Clapton, of course, come up through John Mayall's Blues Breakers, and had several others of that sort of British rock scene, or that British blues scene. He'd been in the biggest supergroup of the time as well. That had imploded under the sheer force of three different personalities. So what was the situation then when Harrison and Clapton first met? Because they were very different guitarists and personalities.
Well, they first met, of course, way back in the earlier part of the Beatles' career at one of their Christmas shows in London. They did 2 years of those, and Clapton was immediately struck by Harrison. He had different means of lesser use for the other Beatles, but George, he really connected with. He was another gearhead, wouldn't you say, Jason?
I think so, yeah. And you know, George saw him initially before they even interacted, and it's really interesting, and this is something I think it's reflected in the narrative. He was very sensitive to this vibe that Eric was giving off, and he said, I remember later that he seemed very lonely and we should ask him to come hang out with us. And and you know, obviously they would get together later, and like Ken says, they would bond over you know, guitars and music.
I mean, it's interesting, isn't it? Because they are, especially as the 60s continue, perhaps two of the best known people on the planet, Harrison with the Beatles, Clapton with Cream, and then we get into the Clapton and his God stage. But at the same time, you know, I mean, I don't mean say, oh, boo-hoo, it must be awful to be a multimillionaire international rock god, but, you know, nobody knows what goes on behind the searing solos.
Sure, it's a pretty lonely place that they occupy. When you put it that way, and I think it's pretty accurate. You know, one of the things that you learn pretty quickly when you begin to study this period and those two people in particular is the way that working with and playing with Delaney and Bonnie and Friends in late 19, I guess it would be 69, was the real turning point for them. You know, outside of these really well-known spaces they usually played in, they've suddenly really bonded and sort of found themselves, right, Jason?
Yeah, that's a pivotal tour for them. Eric, you know, pulls George in and gets him to play, and he's on stage with them, and then does that Scandinavian tour with them. And George discovers a camaraderie in that experience that he's really lacking in the Beatles. And he had seen that the year before when he hung out with Dylan and the band in Woodstock. But here he really just gets a big dose of it. And that's going to affect what he does in the following year with his own album.
I mean, from Sgt. Pepper and then, you know, the White Album, it was pretty clear that the Beatles were going their separate ways. They certainly didn't do any more gigs. All You Need Is Love, notwithstanding, you know, the telecast, the broadcast that went around the world. And do you think that Harrison was missing that you know, that he felt outside the songwriting role. I mean, now we come back and we look at Harrison as a person and as a songwriter and as a guitarist and can perhaps appreciate the nuance that he was doing in a way that Lennon and McCartney, they were writing the big hits. They were writing, you know, the ones that we all remember. But at the time, he found himself being almost a little bit sort of shunted, sidelined from the Beatles.
Sure, they had a very complicated political calculus in terms of Lennon and McCartney being these hit makers, George Martin, the producer, supporting that because, you know, for many years in the Beatles story, when it was happening, they wondered if they were a flash in the pan.
And George really had to fight to establish his own aesthetic and his own ideas. I mean, Lennon McCartney was very different from what he was trying to do. And you see, Isn't It a Pity is, you know, something from 1966, and they reject it. And it takes, you know, 4 years for him to come around to get that onto record. And it still sounds relevant 4 years later. You know, he's really working on his own groove, and he's got no one to support him, which makes this achievement of writing all these songs and doing this incredible album all the greater.
And also, if you look at it, you know, by 69, the Beatles are pretty much on the way out. They're still selling masses of records, but there's no chemistry. They're just literally sort of jetting into the studio to do their own bits. So that's one breakup of a band. Clapton's gone through the breakup of two bands and two really high profile ones. Cream, which people, you know, obviously Disraeli Gears, etc., huge albums, and then Blind Faith, which is the, if you like, the ultimate supergroup, and is hyped in a way that hasn't been hyped before, and then burns out really quickly.
Well, burns out is an interesting way to put it, but you know, again, another cursory look at Clapton, and you realize very quickly he has a knack for making sure that he is creating these kinds of impertinent breakups himself. He breaks up everything he's ever involved in, whether it's relationships or working with bands. And as Jason and I discovered, this is a kind of way that he would reject his sort of own trauma, and we don't want to become armchair psychologists, although we are available, of course, if anybody needs it. But you know, he would do these kind of preemptive breakups, and Cream was one of those, and our favorite, or at least mine, I think Jason agrees with me, is Blind Faith. He is thinking of breaking up that band before they play their first note at a free concert.
And the other thing is the fact that these are serious musicians. You know, Clapton and Harrison never got, I mean, they had a love of the music first. I mean, great, you know, to be lauded, etc., was wonderful, and they obviously enjoyed that sort of rise up through fame. But you know, it gets to the stage with, obviously, the Beatles aren't playing, but they are revered as the ultimate rock gods, and it gets to the stage with Clapton where people just aren't listening to the music; they're just screaming and you know, are writing Clapton has got on, you know, on subway walls.
Yeah, I mean, he's very weary of all of this. And he, I think, you know, what's leading into 1970 and is leading into eventually Layla is that he wants to do something that steps outside of that. He wants a personal statement. He wants a blues album. He wants something that's true and that's authentic. And yeah, I mean, that there's certainly this, you know, as Ken says, this sort of self-sabotage part where he'll break up bands or he wants to get out of these situations before they really have a chance to develop. But he, you know, I think there's also a creative aspect to this too, that we can't ignore.
Yeah. And you know, when you bring that up, Jason, it reminds me too, that he would often use this cover story. They weren't true bluesmen, right? That's why he left the Yardbirds, or they had fallen short of his expectations. And you have to wonder if that's the cover story for the self-sabotage.
Right.
So what's the genesis then, and when does Harrison start laying down, if you like, the foundations for all things Must Pass?
Oh, it's a long process. As I said, he's writing songs. He writes Isn't It a Pity as early as 1966, and Art of Dying as well, and he's just stockpiling these songs that the Beatles not necessarily reject. In some cases they try, like All Things Must Pass, the song is a really good example. They make a pretty good attempt at working at a band arrangement for that during the Get Back sessions, but it never really connects. And one of the things George says in early 1970 in an interview is that the Beatles would sometimes have a hard time. They wouldn't get a song quickly enough. and he would just abandon it because he didn't feel like it was worth putting the effort in. And All Things Must Pass is one of those songs. They routined it and they tried to work up an arrangement, but it never really clicked. It's frustrating to hear those rehearsals and to hear them just go and go and go at it, and it just doesn't work. So it's, you know, he's building this up over many years. At the same time, he's also producing other artists. He's produced Billy Preston, and he's produced Doris Troy, and he's building a group of musicians that he in early 1970, he kind of has this vision of a house band for Apple artists. And what that ultimately turns into, to some extent, is a house band for his own album. He has these people that he's worked with, Klaus Voormann and Eric Clapton, and he has Billy Preston and various other musicians who sort of floated in and out of this, and he begins pulling them in for his sessions. And so it becomes this large group of kind of fluid people. It's never really the same all the way through.
Yeah, that idea of a house band, too, by the way, was really a logical step. And if you go back to Motown, there was a house band, right?
Sure.
You know, the Wrecking Crew was the house band for like 20 different artists, you know, at a time. So it was kind of a natural move and a pretty smart one. It's a shame it didn't catch on more with Apple.
And what about Derek and the Dominoes? I mean, this is Clapton trying to get back to basics, trying to get away from the, you know, the wreckage that he's created.
Well, they sort of invent that during the Harrisons while they're working on All Things Must Pass. And they create this idea, which immediately caused no end of headache for Eric's manager, Robert Stigwood, because, you know, he's selling Eric Clapton, and now Eric is calling himself Derek. And, you know, how do you take that to the world, a world that, of course, is not like today, where we all can know anything at any time we want to? You know, back in those days, of course, rock news especially moved very slowly. And so it was hard to make that argument. And as Jason and I have been able to see recently up close, they created Derek is Eric buttons so that people in the audience could know that this guy is Eric Clapton.
What was the reaction then? I mean, I remember that, you know, I think my father bought the album, and you know, it was a triple album, if I remember correctly. Beautiful box thing. If you think about the albums that were put out immediately by sort of John, Paul and George, I mean, All Things Must Pass is a masterwork compared to the others.
Yeah, I mean, George, he's sort of making a statement, and he's also saying in some ways, look, I can do all this production that the Beatles did, that John and Paul did, that George Martin did. I can do this. And he was there when all this was happening, and he rarely got to express himself. And here he gets to let it all out. He's just exhaling everything that he's built up over all these years. The response to it was overwhelmingly positive in the commercial sense. I mean, some of the critics had a measured response, and some panned it, but it went to the top of the charts pretty quickly, and so did My Sweet Lord.
And actually, if it weren't for Tapestry, right, it would have probably swept many of the Grammy Awards.
Oh yeah. For sure.
Oh, that flash in the pan Carole King album that nobody ever talks about these days. Exactly.
Right. Well, whatever happened to her? Poor thing.
I know. Just one of those 70s casualties or 71 casualties. Yeah. I mean, we can't mention as well. I mean, their relationship, Eric and George, and also of course George's wife, and this has become a bit of an urban legend, hasn't it? About this, the famous guitar solo or the guitar battle.
Yeah, it really had different purposes. And in fact, in a larger sense, and this is, spoiler alert, one of the great letdowns of the legend is the fact that, you know, what in many ways, as Jason puts it so well, they were trauma bonding. You know, Eric had this just absolutely god-awful childhood, and so had Patty Boyd. And they found themselves in a similar space, and they pursued it over a period of years, and it gets probably blown out of proportion to a certain extent. Eric had learned of the Layla legend and was able to tell those ancient stories and think about them, and probably in some way over imbue his infatuation with this very beautiful woman with maybe meaning it didn't really have.
Yeah, he's characterizing it in a very dramatic sense. I mean, you find a myth and you apply that to yourself. I mean, that's what an ego to do something like that.
Yeah, nobody ever does that, right? With relationships.
Right.
This is the first time.
First time ever, right?
Yeah. George was very much into you know, Eastern philosophy, spiritualism. You know, they even, if you like, there's gentle lampooning in movies like Shudder, Yellow Submarine. And Clapton's at a point, you know, by early 1970s, he goes on a call it a downward spiral in terms of his addiction, shall we say? I mean, is that a factor in that? What's the dynamic does that throw into relationships? You know, Patty Boyd aside.
Well, he used it in kind of a right, Jason, in kind of an immature way, you know. Come help me. If you love me, I will stop using heroin. Am I getting that right?
Well, yeah, he had threatened to start heroin and he had already started using heroin by that point, but he was it is a very immature, you know, it's bargaining, you know, bargaining for somebody's affection, which again, not to play armchair psychologist, but he certainly did this with his mother, who rejected him and, you know, pretended to be his sister while he lived with his grandparents. Really, it's a tragic situation.
So it's a belter of an album, as we said before in the UK, it's a belter of an album, but why did you decide to take this particular tack? Because it would have been very easy to say, you know, here we are at the 50th anniversary or the 51st anniversary of All Things Must Pass coming out. It's a wonderful album. Let's just look at George Harrison and the life that he had. But to explore this friendship, you know, and these two great talents, you know, one of them, you can say, you know, Eric Clapton's a fabulous guitarist, because, yeah. And they say, well, have you considered George Harrison? And a lot of people go, well, wasn't he the guy in the Beatles, you know, and we never sort of heard from him again, apart from when he came back in the 80s kind of stuff.
Well, I mean, the albums were, you know, they came out within weeks of each other at the end of the year. And they've had two very interesting pathways. Sometimes they find themselves intermingled, but, you know, one sold spectacularly well. And as you said before, is kind of the masterwork of the Beatles solo records at this time. And then the other kind of barely dents the charts because, you know, I guess if Robert Stigwood was right, nobody could figure out who Derek was. Right. And then, you know, as the years have passed, Layla's enjoyed perhaps an unfair, I would argue, elevation over All Things Must Pass, which to me is the greater work of art. But they are related in that, as Jason said, it was George putting together this house band and it splinters from one project off into the other.
Right. And you know, the thing we discovered, the myth has always been that Derek and the Dominoes was the house band. And that's not quite right. Eric and Bobby Whitlock were there from the beginning. But Carl and Jim Gordon sort of came in a little bit later. They drifted in. So they weren't really a band until about the middle of the sessions. And then that last, you know, week and a half, 2 weeks maybe, they really kind of take over. And you can hear it. Once you sort of line things up chronologically, you can just hear that fire. And they, I mean, really incredible power in those sessions. And you know, they're blazing bright and they're gonna burn out quickly. But you know, that's you know, they're linked in that way. All Things Must Pass sort of gives birth to Derek and the Dominoes.
And how did you go about getting all this information together, putting them in, you know, putting them in a timeline so it makes sense? And also, you know, speaking to it is, you know, are you going back through interviews, archive stuff you can find from the time? Are you talking to people who were in the studios, engineers, etc.? How do you get about putting about this book, All Things Must Pass Away?
Well, the answer is yes. Yes, all of those things. The first thing I did was put together a timeline of everything I could find from every source. And Chip Mattinger, who's written Eight Arms to Hold You, which is a solo Beatles book, had a lot of these dates. And he answered a lot of questions for us to help with the All Things Must Pass sessions. And I filled in other things, you know, outside of that. And that really gave us a backbone. Really, really important to do that in a work like this. And then we just started interviewing everybody we could. Klaus Voormann, Alan White, the engineer on the All Things Must Pass, second engineer, John Leckie, who is incredibly valuable, just lots of insights. He was 20 years old, his first really major, gig.
Wow. That's quite a good first job to sort of to land, isn't it?
Yeah. Ken, did you have anything to add to that?
Well, I'd be happy to, sure.
Yeah, sorry. I thought we'd lost you there for a minute, Ken. I was about to leap in.
No, I appreciate I feel honored with that pause. and we also gained some real insight into, you know, as Jason just said, this timeline was so strange. And, you know, it's a period when things were happening that people did not know were important. So often we would have to take four or five different accounts, particularly when it came to the Layla stories, and try to figure out which one had the most credence. It was like editing a manuscript, you know, like an old Joyce manuscript, trying to understand which parts were accurate and which were apocryphal. So we were doing a lot of work trying to understand that. And we had a lot of fun with a guy named Kevin Harrington, who was Mal Evans' assistant, as assistant roadie with during the All Things from Past session. And when Derek and the Dominoes go off, Kevin Harrington goes off with them too, because he's heard for years from the Beatles and their associates about how fun touring is. And his first tour, God help him, is going to be Derek and the Dominoes, which is, as Jason alluded to a moment ago, this kind of drug-addled, alcoholic mess. And so Kevin got more than he ever bargained for.
So, I mean, what effect did the both these albums have on what was to come in the 70s? Because nobody knew. We could look back now and say, okay, well, you know, this was underlying, you know, Clapton would go on to do his solo stuff and then come back and, you know, be a massive success, and George would continue to, you know, to continue to make these singular albums. But you know, what influence does it have on the decade to come and the artists to come?
It's an interesting marriage that you see echoed throughout the decade, even into the present, between this kind of classic British rock, and because of the elemental addition of Duane Allman, Southern rock, and you begin to hear this kind of hybrid sound, right, throughout the decade. Even when we, courtesy of this new box set of Paul McCartney and Wings, Red Rose Speedway, a lot of the better cuts that they left off the record are these kind of Allman Brothers country rock pieces, you know, that show this kind of sound that's just permeating all over the industry. And of course, the Rolling Stones are performing in that fashion. You can hear that sound on Exile and Main Street. There's just a very interesting emergence of these sounds that just sort of echo across the decade.
I think there's, you know, in a broader sense, there's also this split between the, you know, the very heavily produced, worried over recording, like All Things Must Pass, which took 5 months to make, from tracking sessions to overdubs to mastering, mixing and mastering, and Layla, which took about 2 weeks. You know, yeah. And just like, you know, burn it out. Don't worry about a lot of overdubs. Just get it out there. And as you know, as the decade progresses, you have this split between, you know, these really like massive albums that take such a long time to make and a lot of production, a lot of overdubs, and everything is carefully worked out. And then punk begins to rise, and you know, that's all about immediacy and rejecting all of the studio production.
It's an interesting one, though, because you go back to that, you know, getting things out in 2 weeks' time, and you just went about the Southern rock influence and, you know, Muscle Shoals. And correct me if I'm wrong, which I normally am at 9 times out of 10. But, you know, the Allman Brothers, when it was that part of, didn't Duane play, was it Wilson Pickett? And weren't they, you know, those bands were like, again, that was that work ethic. And you get that Southern rock, which comes with the band, and then you get Skinnerd, and I just played Black Crowes as I came on today, which is a couple of years, you know, a couple of decades later, but still got that Southern feel to it. But that was very much a Southern working, touring, let's put the album out in about 5 days sort of ethic.
Sure. And it runs straight headlong into Eric Clapton, who has a similar kind of work ethic. I mean, you know, if you're in a band with him, you're probably not going to be in a band very long, but at least during that period, but you will work hard. And so, you know, when they put together Layla in Miami in 1970, they work like gangbusters. And then they come back and work another week like gangbusters. And And that's how they were used to putting out records, right? And it is a great example. I love Jason's example just now of punk, right? You know, while punk is coming about, you've got the Who that used to be punks, and now they're spending oodles of time, you know, making Who Are You and all of these big masterworks and Who's Next, et cetera, you know, throughout the 70s of Quadrophenia, right? And you do have this kind of bifurcation that takes place. And in the 80s, what do we have? We have 38 Special, right? And then Molly Hatchet and all of these kinds of Southern rock bands that if it weren't for the twang in the voice, you would almost think it was classic British rock.
What do you hope that people, I could talk about this for the rest of the day, actually, but I'm going to run out of time as I'm going to crash the news. What do you hope that people will take from All Things Must Pass Away, Harrison Clapton and other assorted love songs?
But, you know, the best thing that can ever happen with a book, any book that we work on, is, you know, once you've imbibed some new information and you've read the story in context, you will immediately, you know, or maybe even during the process of reading, you'll open up your favorite streaming device and you'll be listening to the music. If we can bring the music to life, we've done something.
I would prefer people go to their LPs, but you know, that's just me. But I agree. go back. If it makes people listen to the music in a different way, it gives them greater insight. I mean, that's the best.
I have only one more question, gentlemen. The gnomes. Whose idea was the gnomes?
Well, I'll tell you what. If it had been possible, it would be mine. I cannot wait to receive my gnomes. Jason heard 1,000 times already. I will be setting them up in different configurations. They'll be hanging around the house, riding on the backs of my cats.
I expect an Instagram account just for the gnomes, Ken.
Yeah, actually, yeah. Harrison's gnomes has got to be, hasn't it? You know, I can see it now. I can see it now somewhere. It Henley, wasn't it? They shot the picture in his house in Henley, wasn't it, in the end?
Right on his lawn.
This book, it's a brilliant book. It's called All Things Must Pass Away. It's by it's called Harrison Clapton and Other Assorted Love Songs. It's by Ken Womack and Jason Krupa, who I've had the honor of speaking to this afternoon stroke morning. Gentlemen, if people want to find out more about you or about the book, is there social media? Is there a website? Where can they find you?
I'm at kennethwomack.com.
And you can find me on Twitter at PT Beatles, which is Producing the Beatles, which is my podcast on the Beatles production process.
The book is called All Things Must Pass Away. It's available as a download as well from our TRE virtual bookshop. Ken and Jason, it's been an absolute pleasure to speak to you today.
Absolutely. Thank you.